Spring turkey season is upon us, and don't be caught out in the woods without having Onyx Hunt on your phone. One feature Onyx has that is often overlooked for turkey hunting is their recent imagery filter with their elite memberships. This imagery is updated week to week, and it comes in extremely handy, especially when you're trying to find these gobble zones where these turkeys will go out in a high spot on a fresh clear cut and strut around all day long. Actually, I was just looking at it on Onyx where the timber company just came into Andrew's Club and did a very small clear cut along this creek. And I can see the high spots on the topographical map, but also I can see exactly where they mulch. And those are going to be hot spots for finding gobblers, especially mid-morning after they get off their hens, getting up on these little high spots in this fresh, small clear cut along the creek and strutting and gobbling all day long. If you want to give Onyx a try, you can actually download it for free, try it for 7 days. And if you decide to purchase, you can use the promo code Southern and save on your premium and elite memberships. So going into this turkey season, know where you stand with Onyx.
If you're looking to throw some optics on your turkey gun this spring, look no further than the Vortex Defender ST. This is the red dot we're going to be running this season. We're excited about it. This thing's built like a tank, super lightweight, super long battery life, everything you need in a good turkey red dot. And if you want to get a discount on that red dot or any other Vortex optic, go to eurooptic.com and use the code SGN10 to get a discount. That's eurooptic.com, code SGN10. If you live in the Gulf Coast region, you need to find yourself at the EcoWild Expo May 10th through the 12th in Mobile. It is the premier outdoor expo for the Gulf Coast region, and we're going to be there. We're going to have a booth. We're super excited about it. Can't wait to meet you guys that live down there. We absolutely love the Gulf Coast region, so to be a part of this show, we're super excited about. We're going to have past podcast guests there at our booth for you to talk to, guys who are relevant for your area, who you can talk to, you can pick their brain, you can joke with them, laugh with them, tell them your story, whatever you want to do. It's going to be awesome time. We're already working on some past podcast guests, but hey, if you live in this area and you have a suggestion for someone you want to see at that show, write in and we'll see if we can get them. There's going to be all kinds of exhibitors at the show that are focused on hunting, fishing, conservation, and recreation. There's going to be activities for the whole family there. They got axe throwing, archery. They're going to have our podcast booth. And then for the kids, they got touch tanks, a honeybee exhibition, a raptor show, kids fishing tank, BB gun range, and a butterfly house. So you're going to love it. Your kids are going to love it. It's going to be an awesome time. So head on over to ecowildexpo.com to get more information on the show and to go ahead and grab your tickets. And hey, mark it on your calendar, May 10th through the 12th. Be there. We want to see you and we're excited to talk to you. So we'll see you at the EcoWild Expo this May 10th through the 12th at the Mobile Convention Center in Mobile, Alabama. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. Today, we're having an interesting conversation that might ruffle some feathers on aging deer with Mr. Mariah Bogus. Mariah, how are you doing?
I'm doing super good. Nice talking to you guys again.
Dude, awesome, man. Glad to have you back on. I'm ready to ruin everybody's day talking about aging deer. Jacob, how are you doing?
Doing well. Just got back from Arkansas. Super late last night. We'll talk about that at another time, but was able to find the mysterious public land turkey in Arkansas, but they outsmarted us, the gobblers. There was a bunch of them. We finally got in pockets of them. But we're not talking about turkeys in this episode. We're talking about deer. Mariah, real quick, can you give yourself a little introduction on your position with the state of North Carolina, and then also like a little bit of your background that kind of gives us a little idea before we jump into this conversation talking about aging deer?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm the deer biologist for North Carolina for the Wildlife Resources Commission, and I've been here since 2021. North Carolina actually is my home state. It's where I grew up and went to undergrad here, went to graduate school actually at Mississippi State. It was down in Mississippi, kind of down in y'all's neck of the woods for a couple of years. Really enjoyed hunting and everything down there, but when I graduated, I had to move on. After that, I worked up in Indiana as deer biologist for about a year before I moved here. So that's kind of been the most recent jobs I've held. Everything before that was kind of temporary field work type stuff. But all through those years, I've always been a really big deer hunter. That's just my number one thing is deer hunting and deer sheds. It's my top two things that I love to do. And so that's always driven, of course, my career and what I've sought out. Research-wise, in grad school, and then also career-wise, and so right now it's fun. I get to sit here and work on deer constantly every day of my work, calendar, and when there's nothing pressing at hand, I get to read about deer. I get to, you know, read the literature and stuff like that. So I always kind of trying to brush up on the deer research that's out there and new stuff coming out so that I can answer questions for hunters and anyone else I run into and, you know, have questions about deer biology and management. So always happy to have these kinds of talks.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned going to school at Mississippi State. Dude, when you were at Mississippi State, you were hell on those deer around there, man. You killed some nice bucks down in the SIP.
It was a good time. Yeah, I've told a couple people since, you know, because I lived in North Carolina, Mississippi, and Indiana. And I've gone back and I've hunted Indiana. I guess I've hunted it four seasons now. And I've hunted Ohio a couple times. A couple of Midwestern states that people would say are really good for deer. And believe me, the hunting is good there. But it just doesn't compare to Mississippi. That, you know, I'm blowing everybody's cover down there. But people sleep on the South. They really do. I mean, you know, I love Mississippi because there were so many deer. And there were so many just adult, you know, like mature bucks. Bucks that were 3.5 years or older. And even older bucks out there. And yeah, I never saw 150 or 160, you know, inch deer. But the number of large deer that were out there just, you know, it increased your odds. I had a good time down there.
That's awesome, man. Well, the what kind of spurred the idea for this podcast was you and our buddy Mark Turner used to do a podcast called Hunt the Land, and y'all are both biologists, and y'all covered stuff week to week that had to do with like deer biology and everything. And it was y'all did a great show, man. And y'all did an episode one time about aging deer and basically the error associated with aging deer, and just the science behind it. And it was fascinating. So I wanted to kind of rehash that conversation and talk about it today because, you know, maybe people killed some deer last year and they had them aged, or they're going to have them aged, or they're just interested in aging some deer this upcoming season. And I just thought it'd be an interesting conversation and talking about how it can change based on where you are, the habitat, the actual population. So I guess to kick it off, will you give us kind of a breakdown of how deer are normally aged now? Like, you kill a buck and you have somebody like a biologist age it. What are they doing to tell you how old that deer is?
So yeah, if you take your deer to a biologist, they're going to want to look at the jawbone, and they're going to look at first the replacement of teeth for that deer's jawbone. It's kind of a process you work your way through, and you start at looking at how many teeth there are. And then you eventually look at where to give an estimate of age. And I can run through, do you want to just kind of discuss a high level? Yeah, we can talk about it real quick. So when a deer is a fawn, up until it's about 12 months of age, 10 to 12 months of age, before that, it will have 3, 4, 5, and then 6 teeth. When it gets 6 teeth in its mouth, that's the full number of teeth that it will have. Just like, you know, humans, when they're young, they don't have all their teeth. They're not born with all their teeth. So when you get a jawbone, the first thing you do is you count how many teeth there are. There's 3 premolars in front, and then there's 3 molars behind. And I'm talking about the teeth that are in the back of the jawbone. On the front of the jawbone, you'll have incisors, and we don't look at those for tooth wear aging. Just a note to everybody out there, if you've ever looked at a deer, at the front of their mouth, they only have teeth on the bottom. Because just because your deer doesn't have teeth on the top doesn't make it old. I've never seen a deer that had teeth like a horse. I don't think anyone else has either.
He must be 14 years old.
Yeah, it's like he didn't have any teeth left on top. I just picture the scary horror that would be, a deer walking around with big old chompers in the front. bite anything it wanted. But no, so the bottom jaw of a deer only has incisors on the bottom. Then we look at the 6 teeth in the back. So back to the aging process, you first count. If you have less than 6 teeth, you know that deer's a fawn. Now, there's always weird examples. We'll age deer, and if we age a couple hundred jawbones, there'll be one or two that's missing a tooth or has a broken tooth, you know, and I've even seen jawbones that have 7 teeth, just normally 7 teeth, the fact that it just grew an extra set of teeth. There's always exceptions, but once you've looked at one or two jawbones, you'll be able to find those pretty easily. So if there's less than 6 teeth, you know it's a fawn. If you count 6 teeth there, then you know this deer is at least a year old. So we would classify it as a year and a half. We always, you know, culled deer on the half age. So they're 1.5, 2.5, and so on. That's just because they're born in early summer. They're about 6 months old by the first hunting season. So we always give them a half age because that's when the bulk of deer age is in the fall. So when they have 6 teeth, then we have to start looking at tooth replacement. So if there's 6 teeth in the head, we count to the third tooth. That's the third premolar. And that is the last baby tooth to get replaced. So just like humans, deer have baby teeth and they replace them in their first year. And that third premolar will have 3 crests as a baby tooth. And then it gets replaced with a double crested tooth. And if you look at jawbones, you'll know the difference between a double crest and 3 crest teeth. It's pretty self-explanatory. But if that deer has a 3 crested third premolar, we know it's 1.5 years old. And if it has a double crested third premolar, we know that it's at least 2.5 years and older. And at that point, we transition to tooth wear. And I just want to point out, for sake of this argument, or for sake of this conversation, the fawn age group, looking at tooth emergence, looking at number of teeth in the mouth, and the 1.5-year-old age group or yearling age group, we can know with the highest certainty, I mean, pretty much 100%, unless you're careless, you can make mistakes, but unless you're careless, with pretty much 100% certainty, we can know a deer's age by looking just at the teeth. We don't have to cut any teeth. We don't have to do anything like that. Because deer always replace those teeth in the same timeline, you know? And so if we're looking at deer, we can say they're fawn, 1.5 or 2.5 or older. And that's really the best way to classify with tooth wear and replacement, is to say, you know, fawn 1.5 or 2.5 plus. But we can also look at tooth wear, and we can estimate, if you will, how old that deer is just by looking at wear. And at this point on in a deer's life, they're not losing any more teeth naturally. They're not having, you know, any tooth changes. So we just have to look at wear. So you then just start looking at the amount of wear on the enamel, on each tooth, each molar back in the deer's jaw. And essentially, just to quickly describe it, with every tooth worn more to a certain point, we knock it up another age class. So 3.5, 4.5, 5.5, and so on. And I don't think it's worth going into much detail because it's really hard to explain the amount of wear needed on each molar to classify it in an age group. But that's, you know, the high level how the tooth wear and replacement aging method is used. And pretty much every agency managing deer uses that method to age deer in the harvest. And you know, we use it here in North Carolina, and it's very effective for breaking deer into those age groups. Fawn, 1.5, 2.5 plus. And we do try to make estimates into those older age groups. But you know, it all depends on how you analyze the data. Most of the time when I pull our statewide data, I'm looking, you know, if it's a question like for a population model or whatnot, I'm not really breaking down into how many are 5.5 versus 6.5 or 7.5. At that point, it's not as important as just how many adults we have. So that's kind of how it's used.
So using tooth replacement, you basically, if it's younger than 2.5, you have a very high confidence level of how old that deer is. But once it gets mature, basically, it starts getting pretty hazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what we would classify as adult deer, basically 2.5 on. It's just less accurate. And so that's where the recommendation from the literature, if you want to have your best estimate of a deer over 2.5 or 3.5, you should probably use some metamandoli. And we can get into that here in a minute. But underneath that, those age groups from 2.5 and younger, or 2.5, really, from a fawn to 1.5, tooth wear and replacement is the best way to go, because you'll actually get more air in your estimates using some metamandoli. And there's plenty of examples of that in literature looking at known age deer, where you could look at the teeth and know the age of the deer because it only had 5 teeth. There's a study where they sent out a fawn jawbones and they all came back as 1.5-year-olds with some metamandoli. And it's like, well, you can look at the teeth, you know exactly how old that deer is, because we know when deer add those teeth. And you were looking at some metamandoli data, you would have been off a year. So there is a time and place for both methods for sure.
Okay. So I want to, before we move on to the other kind of testing, which I still don't really know how to say, I want to talk about aging a deer. Like you bring your jawbone to your taxidermist and he takes a look at it and he says, oh, this deer was 7.5. Yeah. Is there any studies done or is there any kind of consensus on like how accurate that might actually be? Like, are we hitting on it like 60-70% of the time, or is it like 20% of the time we're hitting on the right year?
So I kind of pulled some data here so that we could talk about this question and a couple others as far as looking at accuracy, and I'll touch on that in a second. If you take your jawbone, you know, anyone can provide an age estimate, and whether they're a trained biologist or not. And depending on how many jawbones they've looked at, they'll probably, you know, at some point everyone becomes just as good of an expert or, you know, just as accurate as anyone else. It all kind of comes down to, you know, at those advanced ages, looking at enough jawbones for an area that you're comfortable breaking apart each age class based on wear. But we have to remember that there is, just like there's variability in antler growth in every age class, there's variability in wear. Some of that is environmental. Some of that is specific to the individual. Like some deer likely have harder teeth than others, or maybe they prefer different types of forages than others. At any rate, each individual is going to wear their teeth a little bit differently. So that's what contributes to some of this variability in wear, which then leads to error in our estimation. So just to kind of set the slate clean, just because we're estimating something wrong doesn't necessarily mean we're doing the method wrong. That's in some part due to just variability in each age class. But just for an example, a study that was done using known age deer in Virginia, Mississippi, some years ago, back in 89, they had 98 known age deer. And they showed these jawbones to 55 biologists from across the Southeast. So people who have a lot of experience aging deer, I mean, would be very comfortable using the method. And the tooth wear and replacement technique was accurate about 62% of the time. Now, there's other projects that were similarly done that show accuracy rates below 50%. There's some others that are, you know, higher than 50%. But it's not, you know, it's not 90%, and it's not 10%. It's somewhere in the middle. And it kind of depends on what age classes you're looking at. With tooth wear and replacement, like I mentioned, we're really good at fawns and 1.5. So if you have a lot of those deer in your sample, it's going to boost up that average accuracy. And if you have a lot of deer that are really old, it's going to reduce that average accuracy. But what we have seen consistently is that from about 3.5 years on and older, with each age class being older, our estimates on the average are more and more off. So, you know, for a 7 or 8 or 9 year old deer, there's just so much variability that many years into a deer's life that it's more likely that we'll be off. So yeah, I mean, if you're asking about accuracy rates, 50%, 60% range, but that is also assessing it based on being any years off. So if that deer was 6.5 and your taxidermist said it's 7.5, that would be counted as wrong in that data set, but it's still within a year. If we're that looking at a deer that's that old, personally, if I kill a deer and I age it, all my own deer just out of curiosity, I'll make an estimate. And then what I always tell myself walking away is, okay, it's hopefully within a year of that. You know, I mean, one way or the other is hopefully within a year of that. I don't know that deer's birthday. You would have to have been there and tag that deer when it was born to know for sure. There's really no way to ever know for sure. But yeah, that's kind of how that plays out. It's older deer, there's just more variability and more error.
Yeah, that you actually bring something up that I'm really curious about. Now, I wish there'd be a study done on that particular aspect of it, because I'm like, if the buck is 5.5 and the guy says he's 6.5, well, you know, he's off a year, so it's wrong. But it's like, if you were to take a year on either side and do it that way, would it be like 90% accurate or something? So I don't know if anybody's ever done something like that, but that I'm curious about that with the tooth wear as well as aging on the hoof too, because I know there's maybe some similar studies done on that where I took a test one time that Auburn put out, and it was like, go through these 50 deer and age them. And it was so bad. I got like 20%. I failed so hard. But then I think what they came out with is like most people fail. Like most people aren't that great at aging on the hoof. But they were doing it the same way. They're all known age deer. And if he's 3.5 and you said he's 4.5 or whatever, or vice versa, you get it wrong. But it's like, well, if you're within a year, I'd be curious at like how much that accuracy or percentage goes up if you were to include like a year on either side.
Right. And oftentimes I've seen numbers reported in some studies, and usually that rate is, if you were to take into account plus or minus 1 year and call that range accurate, your accuracy would, you know, that would account for like 70 or 80% of the errors in a lot of these studies. You know, it's just kind of a neighborhood mark. So oftentimes, and this isn't true even with cementum analyte, oftentimes when it's inaccurate, it's usually by a year or two, you know. But once you start to get up into 10-year-old deer and more, yeah, I mean, you know, being 2 years off, still in the grand scheme of things, you're still, you know, that's, you're still, what, that's only 20% of the deer's age at that point that you're off. It's less bad than if that deer was a fawn and if you aged it as 3.5, you know, that then you're really doing something wrong. So that is pretty typical of the aging process.
Yeah. Another thing that got me curious about this specifically with the tooth wear was a couple years back, our buddy Zach shot a huge buck on a parcel of public land around here. And it's a place that I've been hunting my entire life. And the year before he shot this buck, now, me and Zach have gone back and forth on whether or not it's the same deer, but I was standing literally almost exactly where he shot it the summer, not the summer directly before, but a year earlier than that. So I filmed what I'm 99% sure is this buck. Huge buck, unmistakable, giant frame. He was standing there at 20 yards, and I watched him for like 5 or 10 minutes. Just a nice deer, and I hunted him like one or two times that fall, and I was living in Auburn at the time, couldn't get in there on him enough, and Zach texted me one day. He's like, hey, I'm thinking about hunting this area. Have you ever been in there? I was like, let me tell you what's living in there. And so I just handed it off, you know, to Zach, and he started hunting that area pretty hard, and the next year, he ended up killing that deer. It was a 165-inch buck. He had the jawbone pulled, and our local biologist looked at it without knowing what deer it came from. We didn't tell him, we didn't show him the rack or anything. We're like, hey, how old was this deer? And he's like, 3.5. I was like, no freaking way. No way that deer was 3.5. Because first of all, when I filmed it, he looked like a mature buck, assuming it was the same deer. But so I don't know. And plus just a 3.5-year-old deer in that area having that big of a rack, I don't know. But that's what got me curious and kind of sent me down this road. I'm like, dude, there ain't no way that deer is 3.5 years old. But I don't know. You're a biologist. Maybe you know better than me on that.
And, you know, maybe that deer had exceptionally hard teeth, you know, to go along with his exceptionally large antlers. I don't know. I mean, that's just a shot in the dark. I have seen known-age jawbones before, you know, 20 or 30, where we know for sure because they were in a pen and, you know, we know what day they were born, this is how old they were. And I can tell you there is a lot of variability. I mean, I've seen some before that were from 9.5-year-old deer that day in and day out, I'd age as a 3 or 4-year-old. You know, that's kind of where I would be falling out looking at tooth wear. But the deer was for sure 9.5. And then there's others, you know, that are 9.5-year-old deer and every single tooth is just ground down. It's just all brown. You know, there's hardly any enamel left on top. So there's just so much variability within each age class that, you know, at some point, this is one reason I love deer. You know, they're full of exceptions. It's just like hunting them. You know, if it was as easy as, oh, if you go to the first, you know, white oak closest to the water in any place, you'll kill the biggest buck, you know, something stupid that was easy, it wouldn't be any fun. But deer are full of exceptions and they're impossible to figure out. And in the same way, a lot of the science behind deer is that way because we're dealing with a wild animal. You know, the genetic background, the environmental background, like we can't control any of it. So we're just observing between different populations. And each one of these studies or any population, if you look at any metric across the board, like antler growth or, you know, or average weight, we're always looking at the average measurement. Because that's just what we have to go on. Because if you go on the average measurement, you're right 70% of the time. But then there's always the, you know, it's a bell-shaped curve. So there's always the far right and the far left. And it's the same with any kind of measurement or likely with wear, is that, you know, most deer should wear at about this rate. And that's the method we use. But then, yeah, you have a deer like that, but maybe he was 6 or 7 years old and he just didn't wear for whatever reason, you know, really hard teeth, whatever. He's the far left side of that curve. And he had, you know, antlers for the far right side of the curve, just exceptional. And, you know, So I think with deer, and especially with science surrounding deer, we have to be comfortable with the unknown. And, you know, that's the bottom line. If we think we know everything, you're definitely missing the boat, because there's no way to know it all. And even as a biologist, we can't know it all. We can't look at a deer and know the age for sure. But I do want to point out, these methods, the aging methods, cementum analyte and tooth wear, are there for a reason. We developed them, biologists developed them, to track deer populations over time, so that they can look at age structure and see if age structure changed with, you know, different management strategies, different harvest strategies. And we use them from the aspect of an average population. So if I'm looking at the age structure of a population, I want 30, 40, or 50 deer in each age class. I want to be looking at a, you know, at a data bank with 200 ages or more in it. You know, say, I'm not so concerned about one deer. If one deer is off a year, it's no big deal to me, because there's another deer that's off the year the other way and it offsets itself. That's how it averages out. So from the management scenario, yes, there's error, but we're comfortable with that error, and we factor that into all of our models and understanding about deer, because, well, we just have to live with it. And we're less concerned about being able to know what every single deer's age is, because it's just not important to, you know, to our management questions.
Mariah, I got to ask you this. You're mentioning, you know, with those known age jawbones from the pen, and, you know, there was, you know, say a 9-year-old buck or a 9-year-old deer per se that, you know, if you were to age him, looked like a 3 or 4-year-old, but then other 9-year-olds in the pen, you know, had unbelievable wear. In that situation, are all those deer in those pens getting the exact same opportunity for food sources, whether it's supplemental feed or browse?
I don't know, because I don't know what conditions those deer were raised in, but I would assume they were very close to the same, because there wasn't any kind of manipulative work going on over those years that I'm aware of. And there's other examples of that too. I mean, just in some of the research, just where, you know, deer are aged with the same method, but they fall into different age groups when they're known age. So, but yeah, to your question, I don't know the answer to that one specifically.
Well, that's one thing I'm always curious on is two factors. Like, I've heard of, this is not from a biologist, but I've heard from mostly taxidermists that just see a ton of jawbones, that it seems like deer coming from different areas of the state, different areas of the country, you know, seem to have some different type of wear patterns from what they've seen. Like, you know, even as specifically as different areas of a county, quote unquote, like guys have, you know, 3-4 years of trail cam photos of a deer, they kill it, and that jaw looks so much different from another part of the county where someone has done the same thing, brought to the taxidermist, and he's able to analyze and look at both of them. And it kind of goes back to, like, you know, how much of a factor could be, you know, when it comes to the wear of the food sources that they have opportunities to you know, get a hold of with the browse and or supplemental feeding, but also just the hardness. And that's something I haven't really heard of someone talking about, like how hard a deer's teeth could be, you know, based off their genetics. And, you know, for whatever reason, they just have less wear eating the same food source that, you know, a similar deer in the same area who maybe doesn't have the genetic for, you know, harder teeth that would show more wear eating the exact same food sources, the exact same supplemental feed, whatever it is. That's something that's really interesting. I guess that's that one outlying factor that I don't know if there's any way to test that and figure that out ahead of time. You know, it's just one of those things that, you know, you kill the deer, you pull the jawbone, kind of like the situation with our buddy Zach's buck, where I know that biologist, and I think they took it to the taxidermist. I think the taxidermist said the same thing, like it was 3.5 years old. For whatever reason, just had exceptionally hard teeth for his age. Because knowing where that deer came from, there's not a lot of soft mass or crops or any kind of browse that I would think that would, like, help with, you know, not having as much tooth wear. Just come, 'cause, I mean, he came out of a freaking briar thicket. I mean, just nasty hellhole. Yeah. And that is super, super interesting. And I guess an outlying factor that I guess people should take in consideration, especially if they do kill a buck that they're fairly certain is mature based off, you know, body size, based off just everything about that deer. And for whatever reason, you know, they're getting told it's a 2.5 or 3.5 year old. Well, maybe there's that outlying factor of, you know, just that genetic hard teeth. Is there anything that's been studied on like any of those deer that, you know, for whatever reason, like say that 9 year old, is there any way to test the hardness of a tooth? And anything that's ever been done with that specifically?
So there are ways to test, you know, mineral composition of teeth. And of course you could measure hardness. There's no published literature on that. There's a couple different ways that there could be variation within an individual that would affect their teeth wear. Yeah, hardness of the teeth, which could be a result of, you know, genetics. It could be a result of the quality of foods they had as an infant or their mother had and while gestating. It could also be the acidity of the mouth, you know, and how that affects tooth breakdown. At least within the dental profession in humans, you know, people who are in a lot of different people's mouths and picking at teeth, and not all human mouths are created equally either. Some people really suffer with cavities and other people don't. And that's not necessarily tied to just good dental hygiene. And I'm not trying to get off on a brush your teeth tangent, but you know, I mean, you should brush your teeth, but there is also still just an individual component to it. The other part is environmental. And so, you know, there's a hypothesis out there you hear people talk about a lot, that in sandy soils, for instance, that deer wear their teeth more. And I've talked with people that I really respect, our experienced biologists, who say that they can definitely see that variation even within a county or farther, between sandy soils and non-sandy soils. And that, you know, maybe that's tied to a deer, you know, maybe there's sand getting onto the underside of leaves. You've ever seen that, of course, after a rainstorm, it's making, you know, that's making its way into their forage and that's grinding their teeth more. There's no science out there published to really say that's happening. So it's nothing more than just, you know, a hypothesis now. That could definitely be part of it. There's also research to show that the quality of forage available to a deer determines how much that deer eats. And so if they have really high quality food available to them, that's nutritiously dense, they won't have to consume as much food. And that's been shown in research that consumption rate, or just the amount of food being intaken by a deer, is tied to how nutritiously dense that food is. So if we take that another step further, if a deer is chewing more, well, we could hypothesize that it's probably wearing more too. That's one way forage, and not necessarily forage hardness, but forage nutritional quality could affect tooth wear. So there's a lot of different hypotheses out there, and there's probably merit to all of them, honestly. But there's no substantial scientific backing to any of them, you know, to the best of my knowledge. And there's probably too many factors, to be fair, that affect one individual to another, even within a small population. But across, you know, across populations, some of those environmental ones could be at play. And I'll mention a study here, and I want to talk about a study when we get into cemented analyte here in a minute. But this was a manipulative study back in the 90s in George Reserve Deer Herd, which was a high fence research facility in Michigan, where some of the greatest deer research, early deer research, came out to describe like population density dependence and stuff on individuals' health and size and even reproductive output. So they were constantly manipulating how many deer were in this enclosure, from very few deer and it was a little over 1,000 acres to hundreds of deer within this small enclosure. And they noted that when they had, you know, 100 deer or so, and then they whittled that deer population down to like 10 deer, that the amount of tooth wear on those deer's teeth over those years started to decline. As in future years, when there's fewer deer, they weren't wearing their teeth near as much. And that's probably going back to, you know, what I talked about a minute ago, to where there's probably better forage available to each individual because they weren't competing with as many deer, which led to having to consume less food, therefore chew less and then wear their teeth less. That's connecting a lot of dots, but there's probably something to that.
Interesting. I have a question that is off topic, but I've got to ask later in this episode. I just cannot, I can't forget it, but it has to do with mining and minerals. But well, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. Andrew, do you have any other questions specifically on the tooth wear?
No, no.
So let's talk about this other way that, you know, especially, I guess, more recently, different organizations. I know there's a couple of businesses out there that do this cross-cut analyze of the tooth and kind of, I don't know if it's like the rings on the tooth or whatever. And remind us again, what is the name of this other method for aging deer that's, I guess, a little more detailed compared to just the tooth wear patterns?
It's called cementum analyze. And essentially, it's just taking a cross-section of the root of the front incisor from the deer. And so to pull it incisor correctly, you then need a fresh deer jaw. If you do, you can kind of, I'll take a screwdriver or something and slide down along the root all around that tooth, and then I'll take pliers and gently pull it out. You can't break the root off is why I'm saying that. You know, if you the front incisor extends maybe an eighth of an inch out of the deer's gum line, if it extends an eighth of an inch, the root is down a quarter inch or more. So it's real long, and you try to get it all out of there. And then you send it into the lab. And the main lab that does most of that work is Matson's Laboratory in Montana. They've been in the game for a long time, and they do most of the aging work for all of the wildlife agencies out there that are doing cementum analyze. A lot of the big canids like black bear or felids, you know, like mountain lions and bobcats and whatnot. And even some of the fur bears, the cementum analyze technique, it has really high accuracy, and it's used across a lot of different animals. And Matson's lab again is really the go-to. That's the one that usually does it. There's some newer labs, deerage.com or something like that is a newer one that does that. And I don't know how long they've done it, but they're doing the same technique. It's a cross-section of the incisor. They then stain the root, and there's these annuli, what they call them, essentially kind of rings that are laid down within that deer's tooth, and they're laid down during stress periods. And so as long as an animal experiences one stress period every year, or those stress periods occur at a rate that they know, you know, over time, it could be one or two per year. As long as they know how many it is, they can count those stress rings, and they can estimate the animal's age. And like I said, they can do that with a lot of different animals with really high accuracy. And it's something that, of course, there's, you know, been an application in white-tailed deer ever since with cementum analyze. And you know, right from the beginning, some of the research on cementum analyze has pointed out that it's most accurate at northern latitudes. And we can get into that here in a minute, kind of into the nuts and bolts of that. But, you know, a lot of the work that's been done on it, it has been done at northern latitudes. There are some studies from down south that we can talk about that have a little bit lower accuracy, but that's the method. And so agencies that do this, you know, they might send off a few hundred teeth or so, and they'll all get sent to the laboratory and get ages sent back. But as a hunter, you can send them in as well.
When you think turkey calls, think of Houndstooth. Houndstooth Game Calls is a company based right here in Alabama, actually based out of Tuscaloosa, and they have been making some of our favorite turkey calls since 2012. Y'all head on over to their website, see what they got. They got a little something for everybody. They have a huge selection of different mouth calls, different cuts, different reed configurations. I like to go on there and get five or six different mouth calls and just run them, see which ones I like the most. You know, some days I might like the KB Hen, some days I might like the Ghost Cut. Some situations I might like the Country Girl call, you know, that I can cut on really hard, where on other situations I might like the All Pro that I can get a little bit softer on. Bottom line, there's something for everybody and something for every situation. And hey, you can get 15% off of your order at Houndstooth Game Calls by using the promo code SOP24. That's SOP24. Use that promo code. It'll get you a discount and it helps out the podcast.
Man, Mark's Outdoors is your one-stop shop for everything outdoor and shooting related. They're a family-owned business that's been around for over 40 years now, been serving the Birmingham area, but now they have opened their doors to everyone across the United States through their online store. Again, me and Andrew have been using Mark's Outdoors for years now. They have unbelievable supplies of literally anything that we need we can pick up from Mark's Outdoors. They're even carrying different saddle companies, sticks, platforms, the whole nine yards at Mark's Outdoors. And again, if you don't live in Alabama and you don't want to make the drive to Birmingham, you can go to their website, marksoutdoors.com, and actually shop on their online store to get awesome deals on different products that you may be needing right now and be able to get to you in a very timely manner as well. So give Mark's Outdoors a try. We promise you, you'll enjoy them. They have unbelievable customer service and some of the best guys in the industry. TruLock Chokes has been made in Georgia since 1981 and offering a wide range of chokes, over 2,000 different chokes for all kinds of shooting activities. You might be wondering why you'd want to purchase a TruLock choke, and it's to improve your shotgun performance. Absolutely guaranteed. And as a great example, we have Andrew Maxwell here. And Andrew, you've had some pretty good luck, again, kind of switching out chokes and trying out the Precision Hunter choke from TruLock. So, Andrew, what's been your experience so far?
Yeah, I've used the same choke for several years now. I never really thought much of it, and I got the TruLock choke in. I patterned my gun with the first choke at 30 and 50, and then I switched to the TruLock and changed from 30 to 50. And the 50-yard pattern on my gun with the TruLock choke is unbelievable. Like, everybody's jaws were dropping. Like, when we were out there with Mike and Sam, we were all super impressed. I mean, it's throwing a better pattern at 50 now than it was throwing at 40 before my old choke.
And Andrew, you're shooting the Precision Hunter choke from TruLock. It's a great option. Same chokes I have in my shotgun. So guys, if you want to give TruLock a shot this spring, you can head over to TruLockChokes.com. That's TruLockChokes.com. You can also use the promo code Southern at checkout at TruLockChokes.com and save 10% on your order. Again, give TruLock a shot this spring, especially if you're not happy with the performance of your shotgun, and shoot with a more deadly pattern with TruLock.
So I'm assuming at the northern latitudes, it's probably more accurate because they have a harsh winter they have to contend with every year.
Yeah, so that's the stress period that is really easy to anticipate over time. And especially in areas, you know, like in an arid environment, like say the American West, where we have these really distinct growing seasons, short growing seasons, long winters, the tail end of winter would be that stress period. And it happens year in and year out. It's really predictable. In the South, it's less so. And really the stress period for deer in the South is the summer. The end of summer is the most stressful period for them. And so that likely is, you know, that's part of the reason there's a lack of accuracy in the South, or at least variable accuracy. But I didn't want to loop back. So that study that I mentioned that the Georgia Reserve deer herd, and I talked about tooth wear, the amount of tooth wear declined when they decreased the amount of deer in the pen. Well, they also looked at cementum analyte. And so when they had about 100 deer in this 1,000 acres or more, there was very obvious annuli in the teeth that they were taking from those deer, and they could make relatively confident estimates on the deer's age. And so that's one thing, like if you send them a tooth to Matson's or another lab, they will provide you with a grade for how confident they are in estimating the animal's age. And so these annuli were very obvious in the teeth in these deer from the Georgia Reserve deer herd. And then they decreased the population to about 10 individuals in this pen. And they said that incrementally, as they were whittling down that population, that the annuli in the years following got more and more obscure, to the point where they weren't even laying down annuli annually. And this is in Michigan. So, you know, we're talking about the winter stress period. I mean, those deer were subject to winter, but it wasn't stressful to them, or nearly as stressful to them anymore, because there was ample food for them because of the lack of deer. And so, that's a great example of deer density dependence and carrying capacity, and that those deer were exhibiting these stress rings just because there were so many other animals around them, not necessarily even at a density that was abnormally high for the area. But when they cut it down to a tenth of the density, the deer were no longer stressed, you know, hardly even in winter. And they didn't lay down those annuli. Then they let that population rebound, and they started laying down annuli again in the years afterward when there was a higher density. So it was completely tied to stress. And so, you know, that stress has to occur, and it has to occur at a rate that can be, monitored and used to backdate deer that end up in the lab.
Interesting. Okay. In the South, does a stressor always have to do with food, essentially? It sounds like up north it's a stressor because there's a lot of deer, and then at the end of winter there's like nothing left, and they all are kind of hungry for a while. Down here, there's greenery down here 365. You know, we're never like completely, you know, desolate or whatever. So I guess I'm curious, does it always have to do with food? And then also, what are the accuracy rates that we're talking about for the north versus the south here?
Yeah, so there's no research that really is parsing out the different types of stress and how that is affecting annuli. However, I mean, we know there are social stresses on deer. And that's the other thing that jumps out to me besides just food stress, is that you can have a high deer density and maybe those deer are being subsidized with food from humans or whatnot, and they have plenty of food, but they could still be stressed just because there's so many individuals and there's stress in between those individuals, just inherently by there being so many animals competing and interacting with one another. I can't think of the study off the top of my head or exactly what they were looking at, but there has been research to show that just social stress between deer, like in pens where they're in really high deer densities, but they're getting fed, you know, at libitum, all the food they could want, high quality, there still are markers for stress within those deer. They're exhibiting markers for stress. So that could be another form of stress. But I will say this, in the South, while we do have food throughout the year, there's a really big difference between high quality food and low quality food. And in summer, and this is why the stress, the late summer stress period is important in deer, is that, they, I mean, you walk around the woods in the Southeast in August and September, I mean, everything is green. There is forage everywhere. But the issue, the reason it's stressful for deer is that, well, for number one, they have high nutritional demands during that time of year. So the bar is set high, but the quality of forage is just, it's decreasing sharply then, because all of the plants that were growing early in the season are now, they're lignifying, they're very fibrous, they're beginning to get ready to die for winter. And so there's just not high quality food. And so, like where I'm at here in Eastern North Carolina, say hunting in December, if I'm hunting in Longleaf Pond, I can look as far as I want underneath the understory and there's green. It'll be gallberry and yaupon and there might be some ferns and whatnot. And deer will eat those. And I mean, I've killed deer and seen that they were eating that, but it's not necessarily high quality food. Now, will it sustain deer? Absolutely. It's not like deer starving to death in the South during winter. That doesn't really happen, but that doesn't mean that they're not getting stressed if there's not high quality food for them. So that could definitely be one of the stress periods, you know, if there's just not good food for them. And as far as, you know, touched on the point of accuracy rates between the North and the South, there's a handful of studies that have been done on cementum annuli, and I'm just going to go through a couple of them here, kind of touching on accuracy rates. There's one that was looking at mule deer and elk and white-tailed deer in Montana, and looking at deer they knew the age of, and in white-tailed deer, they estimated the age accurate about 85% of the time, and that, just in kind of a brief literature search here this morning, that's the highest rate for white-tailed deer cementum annuli I could find, is 85%. And that one is actually cited quite often as the accurate, or, you know, as this is the accuracy rate for deer. But again, that was in Montana. You know, there's the very defined stress period for deer in winter in Montana. A recent study that was done in Iowa, they looked at 473 deer. This was Iowa DNR. They pulled incisors from deer, 473, and they sent them off, both incisors from the front of the deer. So these are called like a paired study. So they were sending number one and number two. The lab doesn't know this. So the lab just sends back their age estimate like they would for any other customer. And then they look at the disparity between those two to try to get an idea of where there might be inaccuracies, or, you know, whether it's inaccuracies in the method or, again, variation in individuals that's causing these different ages. And that study, between those 473 deer, about 19% of those were returned, those paired samples were returned with different ages. And, you know, they were almost all entirely only 1 year off. They're mostly 1 year off. So you're still within 1 year, assuming that one of those is the correct age. But again, I mean, that kind of speaks to there being variation. I mean, even in Iowa, where I would call that a pretty northern latitude, there's a lot of winter stress up there, just because of the harshness of winter, there's still variation even between incisors sitting right next to each other and the annuli that they display and being able to read those. In another study, and this is much older, unpublished data from Arkansas, they looked at 34 known aged deer. And in that study, the accuracy rate was 31% with cemented mannuline, and tooth bearing replacement was around 77% in that study. And of course, this is more just anecdotal. I'm taking little spots from here and there across the board. And then there was this other one. I mentioned this earlier. This is from Mississippi, where they sent in their sample, there was 5 fawns, and they all came back as being yearlings. And in that same study, they also sent in yearlings, and only 17% of those were returned cemented mannuline as yearlings. And again, they were getting overaged, I believe, in that instance. And on those study sites, one of the conclusions was there must be another annual contribution to these annuli. So in other words, there's another stress period contributing on this site in those teeth, which is making the cemented mannuline method inaccurate compared to tooth bearing replacement. So you can extrapolate that down into other ages past 1.5 and so on, and you would have an inaccurate estimates of the deer's age. So there's still, I believe, that there still is a lack of a really good study, quantitative study, with known age deer at various latitudes from the far south to the north. I would love to see a study from Florida, mid-south, Midwest, and then maybe New England or the northern Midwest, and look at accuracy rates. We don't have that right now. We just have these few known age deer studies around. And then there's a couple that compare cemented mannuline to tooth bearing replacement. But the issue with those is you don't know what the true age is. You're just comparing two methods that are both flawed. But anyway, that kind of answers the question. There is evidence to say accuracy rates are lower in the South. I mean, they might be half of that of what they're in the North. But even in northern sites, it's going to depend on what that stress period is, and likewise in the South.
Would also another stress period be if there's any significant droughts in any regions of the country? Would that also be classified as one of the stressors?
Absolutely. And that would be a good example of an annuli that could be laid down in a tooth 1 year and no others. It would just be kind of an anomaly.
Is that one of those things that could also throw off that age prediction, unless it was like known ahead of time, like, hey, this deer came from air, there was a significant drought 2 years ago or something like that? I mean, is that something that kind of take into consideration if they have that kind of data point?
It could definitely throw off the age estimation. And yeah, I mean, if you were dealing with a large enough sample size, you would start to notice, especially if it was a known age deer and you were doing one of these studies, you would begin to notice very early that all of your ages are, on average 1 year off. And then you could calibrate for that. The issue is knowing that, and of course, knowing how big of a stress does it have to be to lay down an annuli. That's the other unknown. And so, again, we're dealing with a wild animal, and there's so many other factors out there in the environment that can stress them. I mean, even an individual injury, say, a deer breaking its leg or who knows what, could theoretically contribute to a stress ring. So that there's, and not because it's a bad method, it's just because we're studying a wild animal in a very, is in an environment that's full of variables, it's just never going to be 100% accurate.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. And that's a good point about the drought too. I was also wondering, which you kind of just answered this, but I was also wondering if they take like site-specific environmental factors into consideration, because that, I guess that would be a stressor down here, because it seems like every 2 or 3 years, like, we get a pretty bad drought at that very end of summer time frame. And I've talked about on here before that when I shot my first archery deer, it was during a drought, and I was hunting a watering hole in a creek, like, because the creeks, even creeks that run dry or run all year, were running dry. And so I was finding, little pools here and there, and they were coming to them like a freaking African watering hole, like you see guys hunting on safaris. So I could see how that would definitely be a big stressor.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, what are some of your takeaways from this, like, as a biologist, but also as a deer hunter? If you're killing a deer and you're very curious about how old he is, let's say you shoot a mature buck, I mean, what is your process like when you're trying to figure out that, or like, what is your thought process like? Like, I'm going to look at this and then that, and then I'm just going to accept that it's probably about this accurate.
Yeah. You know, on average, so across where I hunt in the Southeast, I have not yet sent in a deer for cemented antelope from the Southeast. And that's just because I've read enough of these reports that I wouldn't have that much confidence in what it told me. Not that it's going to be numerous years off, probably within a year or two, but I feel like I'm probably that close with tooth wear and replacement, and it's not worth the money to me. I've sent in teeth from out west, you know, an elk a few years ago, a pronghorn, but those were from areas where there was definitely a winter stress period. And just knowing the environment, you know, I felt more confident in what they would tell me. If I were to kill, you know, a deer in, say, Indiana, you know, Kentucky, I don't know, somewhere where the Mason-Dixon line and on up, or, you know, even down into the Midwest, like even down into Missouri, say, you know, down there, the seasons just are more defined than here on the East Coast. If I were to kill a deer there and I want to know the age, I would probably age it with my tooth wear replacement first. If the deer ages as 2.5 or 3, I'm probably not going to be too concerned past that, because again, on average, tooth wear replacement is more accurate at young ages, and cemented is more accurate in older ages. But if I, you know, at that point, if the deer is 4.5, 5.5 or older in tooth wear replacement, I don't have that much confidence in tooth wear replacement past, you know, 2 or 3, then I'm going to be real curious. I would send in that tooth for cemented annuli, and then I would probably take the age that I had from tooth wear replacement, the one from cemented annuli, and just tell myself it's probably within that range. And I'm not going to know the exact age for sure. And I know sometimes, I mean, that, you know, that answer is really frustrating. Everyone, I mean, we want an answer to everything, right? We want to know how, old my deer is, darn it, right? I killed this big buck, right? And I do too, but, you know, it's, all we have is the estimate, and that's just kind of, you know, what we have to run on. So for me personally, you know, I wouldn't worry about getting a deer from the deep South age with cemented annuli. If I had some deer from elsewhere, and there's a minimum sample count. You know, if I was trying to get over that minimum, I might throw it in there just for curiosity's sake. But beyond that, I wouldn't be super concerned, you know, killing a deer in Mississippi, say, to get an age with cemented annuli. There's just too many variables. I would have, you know, and I do this myself. I age a lot of deer professionally. I age my deer myself, but I always send it to other people who also have a lot of experience aging deer, because everyone sees things differently. And there's nothing to say that just because I've aged deer, you know, that I'm an expert and know 100% of the deer I look at. So I'll send it to someone else. Also, by the way, I found that I have a lot of bias with the deer I kill, believe it or not. So I'll send it to someone else and I'll get a different age. I'm like, okay, they're probably more right. You know, they said it's a year younger than what I said. That's kind of, you know, I try to just kind of average it out in my head. You know, I'll get several different age estimates, average it out, and that's probably as close as we're going to get to the actual age.
Also, one other thing, when you're talking about the cemented annuli, I just botched that so bad. But with the crosscut, and you're looking at, you know, these stressor points. So I've taken 2 deer in Iowa. I saved the jawbone from my last one from this past season. Did you mention that, like, it has to be a fresh tooth, as in, like, you need to send it off right when you kill it, or can it be from a jawbone from, you know, that's kind of dried out at this point?
It can be from a dried out. You'll just want to, because that root will break very easily, you'll just want to, I would boil it personally, or soak it in water for a few days. But if you boil it for an hour or two, that'll soften up that tissue and that bone enough that you can get the root out. You know, a fresh one, you don't have to do that. But yeah, being aged, you know, a couple of years old, dried out, that won't affect that. And, you know, and from Iowa, I would think you would get a pretty close to accurate age estimate, especially if that deer's over 3 or 4. That's what I would bank on if I were, you know, in that kind of place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. His last one I shot, I've never seen a deer that had like this grave of face, and he just looked old and worn out. And he was,
that he had a broken front left shoulder and leg. More than likely, probably got hit by a car. And and I'm very interested in kind of saying that. I've still got the jawbone in the back of my truck. And thought about that. And also, the other thing I was going to ask about with that study, like, you have to pull that tooth and that root out. You can't take a cross-cut section with, like, a saw and send, like, that whole, like, little section of jawbone with the tooth intact to them. They're going to want just the tooth and the root.
I'd have to look back at their directions. I'm pretty sure they want just the tooth.
Okay.
I can't say the other laboratories. They might take the end and do the extraction for you. And I'll be honest, I mean, the first one I did, I broke that tooth right in half. You know, I got impatient and I learned my lesson. So yeah, I would say just take it real slow and you'll be able to lift it out of there. It just takes a little time. Slide a screwdriver down the front of it to kind of loosen that root, wiggle it back and forth and pull it out. Also, what I'll do is I'll take a knife and I'll slice that knife down into the bone on either side of the tooth as far down as I can, almost trying to cut the jawbone, you know, just straight down. If you're to follow that tooth line down, you're cutting it right down along the roots. That really helps loosen that tooth up. I don't think they'll take the front, though. I think they want just that tooth.
Yep. Okay. Gotcha. Andrew, do you have any other questions?
No.
I'm going to throw this for a loop real quick.
Are you doing your little mining question?
Yeah. Right? So
yeah.
I've had this theory for a while. And again, this is very much a theory. We probably won't be able to get an answer accurately from you, but I'm just curious. So I was just in southern West Virginia and drove through western Kentucky. And, of course, those areas have a tremendous amount of coal mining. Okay. And with the extraction, especially from the surface mining, you know, the extraction of all these minerals, the coal and everything kind of get uplifted. Also, these are areas that produce absolutely massive deer, you know, in both areas of these states. One thing to do with southern West Virginia is because it's a bow-only counties, those four counties down there, which, of course, is going to tremendously help deer population because it's a lot harder to kill. Has there been any studies with mining, especially surface mining, extracting minerals and bringing minerals to the surface to potentially do anything for antler growth for deer that live in and around those areas, eating forage from in and around those areas?
No research that I'm aware of. My biologist answer would be that it's probably... I think it is 100% habitat related, but I think it's more related to just there being open ground for those deer that's providing them good forage. I mean, that's why eastern Kentucky, southwestern Virginia, southern West Virginia, that around the strip mines that have been reclaimed, that's where you find the elk. Like, that's where the successful elk reintroductions, East Tennessee is an example. They're all centered around those areas. And, even the animals that are there, they could walk away, and a few do, but most of them they stay around those open strip lines. And it's related to the forage that has regrown there, just because they went into close canopy forest and opened it up, and now there's a bunch of forbs available to those animals. And it's probably more related to that for the deer, you know, in those areas. There could be some minerals that have been unsurfaced due to mining. For the most part, if we're talking about high quality forage, let's say common ragweed or, we'll use common ragweed or partridge pea or just any of these real common, widely spread weeds that deer eat, that they provide all of the nutrition that the animal needs, even on a poor site. What's usually the limiting factor is availability of those forbs. And kind of, looping back to what I mentioned about the George Reserve and when they reduced the deer lost the stress rings completely, even in Michigan. They didn't have to, they didn't put any minerals out. They didn't put any subsidized food out for those animals. They just reduced the number of mouths feeding out there, which allowed more high quality forage for each deer. And I would argue, I'm sure that when there was 100 deer in those pens, they weren't starving. They were probably well fed. They had all the food they needed, but they weren't necessarily eating all of the most highly nutritious food that they could get. Yeah, similar on the coastal plain down where I'm at. there is a little, there's a very limited amount of those types of forbs down here for deer. There's a whole lot of kind of crappy shrubs that they can eat. And so, you know, just getting more high quality forbs out there usually is the name of the game, and increase the antler growth. But I mean, I can't say whether or not that happens a little bit.
But more than likely, it's just because the open, expansive landscape allowing for those forbs to grow versus a closed canopy forest, and kind of like what that would provide. So, again, more high-quality forage, not necessarily to do with anything of minerals, but it's more high-quality habitat that would allow those forbs to grow in order for those deer and, of course, elk and everything to feed on them, but specifically whitetails. Is that kind of like an advantage of being able, and again, not to get too sidetracked here, of having more open ground for those forbs to really, you know, express their full potential and really, you know, cover the landscape versus, you know, areas that's going to have a lot more just kind of closed canopy cover? Because a lot of people look at, you know, I think hardwoods, and this is, might be for another episode, maybe to do with you, you know, hard mass is such like a great food source during a certain time of the year. But at other times of the year, it's not really providing them anything. Versus yeah. Open landscapes, the open habitat that could provide more of those forbs throughout, you know, other parts of the season, even later in the season, being a higher quality habitat food source for them that maybe we don't have as much around, unless you go in very specific areas of the country where they have a lot more open landscape, you know, in those kind of areas.
Yeah, I mean, if I were describing the ideal property for a deer, it would be probably 90% open. And, you know, a lot of that would just be wherever you were, remnant prairie. It would be just the native plants. You'd have to manage it to keep it that way. But native plants, which are mostly weeds, what we call weeds, broadleaf plants, growing so that deer can eat them. A forest component is important for deer, as you mentioned. Mast in the fall is important for deer, but it's a very short-lived food, and it doesn't happen every year. So, you know, to have 95% of your landscape in a cover type, being oaks, that only produce a high-quality food for a month every 3 years just doesn't make sense. It would be, you know, it's a lot more advantageous from a deer perspective to have the bulk of your landscape being those foods that deer eat most months out of the year. Having open ground is key for having a high carrying capacity for deer and therefore providing a lot of food for them. But more so than just having open ground, I mean, if you have hay pasture, it's not going to be that great. If it's all just soybeans or all just corn, it's not going to be that great. Corn and soybeans is great, but you know, deer are only going to eat that during certain times of year. They need a mixture of everything. So you also need that component of just open native landscape. And so, you know, when you look at some of the areas that grow the biggest deer, they have that component and they're kind of known for it. I mean, you think about Kansas, you know, everyone wants to go to Kansas. Well, what's a lot of Kansas? It's remnant prairie. I've been there, some of their pastures that have, they run a cattle on, still have a lot of remnant prairie within them. They have a lot of those native forbs available to deer, but they also have ag. They also have a little bit of hardwoods and what, you know, and what else. And so, that's just an example. But even if we look at, say, Illinois, if you're in an area of Illinois, like Northern Illinois, there's big deer, but there's a whole lot, there's a lot less deer in areas of the Midwest that are 95%+ agriculture. Same with Indiana. You know, it's when you get in the Golden Triangle or whatever they call it in Illinois or in any of these Midwestern states, there's an area that's the Fertile Crescent for growing big bucks. And almost always, if you look at the landscape there, yes, there's still ag, but it's not nearly the amount of landscape it is in the rest of the state. And in those areas, it's a matrix of forest. There's some open ground and there's agriculture. And the driftless area of Wisconsin is a great example. That's, you know, Buffalo County, the biggest Boone and Crockett County. It's all dairy land up there. The side hills are forest. The tops and the bottoms are cultivated. And it's not just all corn. Because it's dairy, they're growing alfalfa. They're growing, and they grow it in strips, you know, alfalfa, beans, wheat, everything. It's just it's a matrix of a whole lot of different types of cover. So, that's really the biggest key is just variety. And anywhere where you end up with just a monoculture of one cover type everywhere, even if it's corn, it's just not as good as having a variety of everything, you know? So I mean, deer love the spice of life. That's just, you know, variety.
Awesome. Yeah, Mariah, I've already got another topic I want to do a podcast with you, and actually may have our buddy Kyle Eibarger sit on as well, talking about some more open ground and just that prairie remnant, because that is kind of fascinating when you go to areas like that and, you know, how everything thrives in those areas. But, you know, a lot of people don't like the whole idea of cutting timber because they associate whitetails with timber, but that's not necessarily the case. So, very interesting discussion. But, Mariah, is there anything else on, you know, aging, any kind of things that we've missed or haven't discussed upon, whether it's from any kind of studies or anything like that, that'd be worth mentioning? Or, of course, just your overall thoughts and opinions on this topic to kind of round out this episode?
No, I think we hit all the high points. I would just sum it up as that, you know, understand there's air in it, and it's something we all have to get used to. I think as scientists, we're really used to, you know, by de facto, when we get a question, the answer is always, it depends. And, you know, we average everything out, and the answer is the average. But on both ends of the average, there's these exceptions, and the natural world is full of exceptions. So as scientists, I think we're pretty used to the idea that, oh, we're wrong part of the time. The goal is to be right most of the time and have an average that is more or less correct. And, you know, understand that these aging methods, for the most part, they were developed for applications in wildlife management, where we're dealing with sample sizes of hundreds to thousands of deer. You know, we'll age this past year alone over 10,000 deer, you know, something like that across the state. That's all going into a data set, you know, over time. If one deer's misaged here and there, that doesn't really mess up that data set, because we know there's air in it. We factor that in. So these aging methods, you know, that's where they're best suited. They're best suited for large data sets and understanding how a population changes over time. And they work well for that. You know, that's their intended purpose. As hunters, we have adapted them to our own, you know, for our own uses and our own questions. Nothing wrong with that. I'm a hunter, and I love to try to get an idea of the age of my deer. You know, when I kill one, but when I kill a deer, that's a sample size of one. And, you know, if we're wrong half of the time, it doesn't make me feel that great about the answer I get on it. But I think, you know, if you kill a deer and it gets aged by a biologist or so on, or someone with a lot of experience, say they say it's 4 or 5 or whatnot, just, you know, that's the best answer you're probably going to get. And just know that it's probably within 1 year plus or minus of that. And that's really all we should, you know, all we really need to know. You know, that kind of the end of it. There's really no silver bullet for knowing the deer's age. There is some work going on. You know, someday there's some genetic methods we might be able to dig into a part of the deer genome, like where we can actually look into the genetic structure from an animal and estimate its age. There's promise to that from other animals and adapting it to deer. But as of right now, there's no silver bullet. And so, you know, as a deer hunter, it's a little frustrating to me, but I don't know. Deer are full of unknowns and answers we'll never have. So that's kind of the fun part at the end of the day. And, you know, getting an age estimate, I still keep track of all of them. And I just know they might, a couple of them are probably off. Oh, well.
Awesome, man. Well, Ryan, it's always fun talking deer with you, dude. This has been a super interesting conversation. Is there a place where people can kind of follow along with you? Anything kind of new going on with you in the deer woods or deer research or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I don't post that much stuff anymore, but my Instagram is Mariah Biologist, and that's pretty much the only place I'll post something. But, you know, if I'm out deer hunting or whatever, that's what gets me going. So deer hunting and shed hunting. Yeah, follow along with me there, and looking forward to another fall in the deer woods. We're only 4 months away now, so it's getting close.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on, dude, and we'll talk to you later.
Sounds good, guys.
You guys seem to really have enjoyed over the last year where we've went to a Q&A format every Thursday on the show where we answer some listener questions. Now, some of the most common ones that we get have to do with gear, but also how to find a good hunting buddy. You know, I'm really lucky to have a hunting buddy like Jacob. We've been on a lot of incredible hunting trips together over the years, and it's just nice to have somebody that, you know, is always down to go on that trip that you've always wanted to go on, or who will wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go get that gate before someone else does on public land with you, whatever the case may be. And like I said, we get a lot of questions on how do you find, you know, a group of people who enjoy that same thing so you can kind of network and make some connections. The Mobile Hunters Expo is the place to do that. Y'all heard us talk about it last year, and guess what? This year it's happening in Dalton, Georgia. We're going to be there June 28th through the 30th. We're going to be there all 3 days. We're going to have a booth. You can come talk to us. We talked to a lot of you guys last year, had a ton of fun. So looking forward to that again. But guys, I'm telling you, this is the place to come network. And there's going to be a ton of you guys there. A lot of Southern Outdoorsman podcast listeners are going to be at this show. And actually, Friday, June 28th, there's going to be an after-hour social after the expo. So what better place to go kind of intermingle, hang out with a bunch of like-minded people, and probably pick up a couple new hunting buddies. So you guys don't miss it. It's June 28th through the 30th. I'm telling you, if you listen to this podcast, this is an event you need to be at. Now, we'll see you guys at the Mobile Hunters Expo June 28th through the 30th in Dalton, Georgia.